Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Regeneration, The Rescue of a Wild Land, by Andrew Painting, narrated by Roger Clark. Prologue. The Nature of the Beast. Landscape is the work of the mind. Its scenery is built up as much from strata of memory as from layers of rock. Simon Sharma, Landscape and Memory, 1996. We do not come to nature as impartial observers. We all have an emotional and cultural attachment to all the life with which we share the earth, from the smallest weed to the tallest tree. Such experiences and interests have the power to enrich and enhance our relationships with nature. They also have the power to complicate and destroy them. This is worth remembering as we explore stories of the conservation efforts underway at Mar-a-Lago State National Nature Reserve, with its ancient pine woods, subarctic mountains, and rolling bogs and moors. The estate sits at a complex and often awkward juncture between these real and imagined landscapes. It is a deeply beautiful place, with the power to affect humans in ways that few other British landscapes can. It is a place of soaring eagles and roaring stags, a refuge for some of the rarest creatures in Scotland, a place of deadly cold, avalanches, and remoteness, where the redstart still sings in the spring, birch budburst, and the salmon still runs up cascades. It is an ancient landscape, which provides us with links to our past and refuge from our present. But it is also a contested place, which has been damaged by conflicts that blight the nature of Scotland and continue to divide its people. In recent years, it has become a place of cooperation and compromise. It is cared for by a bewildering array of people. This book is about that work, the people who do it, and the creatures that inspire them to do it. Their work is not easy. In fact, it is often extremely difficult. It has led to acrimony and hostility. It remains controversial, difficult, hard to pin down and understand. Yet this book is a collection of stories of regeneration, redemption, and reconnection, of chances taken to fight the destruction of the environment, of collaboration and communication between different groups and cultures to make a better future for everyone. These are stories of people from all walks of life coming together and striving forwards to a new, biodiverse future, where humans can forge new relationships with nature, in new, enriched landscapes of the mind. In a world of mass extinction, these are rare stories of hope. The whole unabridged story of Mar-a-Lago Estate stretches back 10,000 years and more. It is a story involving queens and kings, princesses, dukes, earls, hunters, Jacobites, crofters, scientists, poets, adventurers. This is the place where a young Byron nearly met his end, and where Nan Shepherd was inspired to write her greatest works. This land has been buffeted by centuries of human use and abuse, by grand tides of history and events with a capital E, by wars and clearances, by lawsuits and climate change. Events have a great bearing on this story, but it is not always grand actions and heroic deeds which make the world a better place. It is often the gradual accumulation of small acts of kindness and curiosity and skill. So this book is filled with these little events. A person looking for wood ants, another counting trees, another stalking a deer. These little events, over time, become big events, gain traction, then movement, and slowly the world becomes a better place. The catalyst that set many, but by no means all, of these remarkable little events in motion happened in 1995, when the National Trust for Scotland, with significant help from a number of people and organisations, acquired 30,000 hectares of some of our most celebrated land, It was to be held in trust for the benefit of the nation. This book is a celebration of that event. It tells some stories from the front line of environmental conservation. I've been on the scene in a minor capacity at Mar Lodge for the last few years. I've been given a ringside seat to some of the most exciting, progressive conservation stories currently playing out in Britain. The future is far from certain, and our environment faces greater challenges than ever before. But these stories show that there is still hope for the future. Mostly, though, this book is my way of answering a thorny question which has dogged my career. It is posed at parties, social events, any time I have met someone new, or even reunited with someone I've not seen for a few years. It is an annoying question, because to answer it properly takes slightly longer than the socially acceptable amount of time that one has to answer a question about one's job. What does an ecologist actually do? Introduction. Three trees. For words, like nature, half reveal and half conceal the soul within. Alfred, Lord Tennyson, In Memoriam, 1849. May is the finest month in Scotland, and it is sacrilege to spend even one May day indoors. There are hundreds of thousands of trees on my large estate, and millions of seedlings and saplings. But there are three particularly interesting specimens, and I'm setting out on a minor pilgrimage to see them. It's a cold, clear, still day. I've started early because it is a very long walk. I leave from the old stables, eaves thronged with house martin nests, walk out past the blackcap singing in the willow by the burn, and head along the back road. I walk past Mar Lodge itself. It is a grand, imposing, red-granite, red-tiled mansion, with two large wings stretching out east and west. It is not as old as it looks. Queen Victoria laid the first stone in 1895. The wildlife is in overdrive at this time of day. A brown hare lopes across the lawn. A red squirrel scampers up an old pine, its claws making a distinctive pitter-patter against the pine bark. I take a turning off into Doira Brat, the wooded brae, the Mar Forest. Most of the place names at Mar Lodge have Gaelic roots. I've provided rough translations to English where useful. For a fuller treatment of the place names of Mar Lodge, I'll push you in the direction of Adam Watson and Elizabeth Allen's The Place Names of Upper Deeside. It's open woodland, grand old pines and birches, interspersed with thousands of young trees crowding the path. A mile or so on, I surprise a black grouse. Unlike red grouse, they don't call out your rudeness with an affronted, go back," but they do still make a meal of their departure, all ruffled feathers and hurt pride. It gives me pause to stop and listen. It's a gorgeous morning, and the clear air is full of song, willow warblers, tree pipits, red starts, tits, chaffinches, crossbills, siskins, cuckoos. There's a great spotted woodpecker calling, and a minute after I hear a green woodpecker, which is something of a novelty this far north. May is the finest month in Scotland because it combines the best weather with the most wildlife. Sometimes you can walk around the Cairngorms without seeming to find any wildlife at all, but not on a fine day in May. It is a strange thing in Britain to come across a landscape that is literally full of wildlife. And yet here it is. Mar Lodge estate sits in the heart of the Cairngorms, the mountains in the middle of Scotland. It is a two-hour drive from Edinburgh in the south and from Inverness in the north. The area covers the land to the west of the village of Braemar, renowned for its Highland games, and to the east of Glen Tilt, from the waters of the Dee to the peak of Ben MacDhui. It is a place of extremes and contradictions. It forms part of the largest stretch of high subarctic ground in Britain. It is the largest national nature reserve in Scotland, 50% larger than the next biggest, and 3,500 times larger than the smallest. It sits slap-bang in the middle of the Cairn Gorms National Park, the largest national park in Britain. It takes 3 days to walk the estate's march, the boundary, if you're fit. The land boasts 15 Munros, hills over 3,000 feet, 914 meters, and 4 of the 5 highest mountains in Scotland. It has the highest source of any river in Britain. It is the coldest, windiest, snowiest place in Scotland. It holds its snow all year round, and snow can fall in any month of the year. It has 11 national and international environmental designations, a bewildering array of initialisms and acronyms. SPA, SAC, NNR, SSSI, SAM, NSA, WLAGCR, designed to protect it from the worst in ourselves. Over 5,000 species have been recorded on the estate, well over 10% of all the species found in Scotland. It is an ancient landscape of granite, hewn over hundreds of millions of years, hunched over by time and hollowed out by ice. But it is also a landscape of seasonal renewal and growth. It is a wild land, often inaccessible, yet it has as rich a human history as anywhere in Scotland. It is thrumming with wildlife, and yet its soils are thin and acidic and spent. It is home to some of Scotland's most charismatic creatures, but is missing many more species which were driven to extinction in Scotland by humans. It has suffered at our hands for centuries, yet remains one of the best places in Scotland for wildlife. And here, in the Mar Forest, on a beautiful early morning in May, it is full. And here is our first specimen, the second largest recorded Scots pine in Scotland. Scots pines are the trees of the Cairn Gorms, and what trees! There are few greater pleasures in life than walking through a pine wood after a downpour, breathing in the resinous smell, and listening to the chaffinch's tinkling, jangling song, knowing that you can walk for an hour and not reach the limit of the wood. To see a glen draped in thousands of giant, ancient pines, with their shaggy, gingery red bark and dark green needles, is to see one of the last great natural spectacles afforded to us in the UK. In 1993, the renowned Cairn Gorms scientist, Dr. Adam Watson, sat at the foot of this particularly magnificent granny pine and was interviewed for the TV show Scottish Eye. Watson had spent his life studying, living with, and striding around the Cairn Gorms. As a child, he had explored Mar Lodge's woods and mountains. He had worked here as a gillie for a spell in the 1950s. He knew the ground as well as anyone alive. By the 1990s, he was known as Mr. Cairn Gorms, a title that suited his somewhat wild appearance, with his long ginger and white beard and loping gait. He was also known as a thorn in the side of the establishment. The heather and blaeberry around him were clipped low. A dead deer calf that had starved that winter was decomposing by the tree. What concerned Watson was that there were no young trees. They had all been eaten by deer. In fact, almost all of the young trees that had been produced by the Mar Lodge pines for the last 200 years had been eaten by deer. Watson told the TV crew that the greatest challenge for wildlife in the Highlands was an overabundance of red deer, which was suppressing woodlands, causing them to age and die, and not be replaced by younger trees. "It's an old place," he said, in his soft Aberdonian accent, "but it's a decaying place." He argued that big Highland sporting estates which managed the land so that people could shoot deer for sport were destroying the land for the rest of us. He pointed out that after centuries of forestry operations, the number of deer at Mar Lodge was far higher than what the already depleted woodland could support. In fact, there were more deer on the land than at any point since the last ice age. "If nothing was done," he said, "the Caledonian pine woods, which always had been a part of the Scottish landscape and culture, would be lost. In 2011, volunteers with the Woodland Trust made the same journey to the Big Tree. They were the ones who measured its girth and found it to be the second largest recorded Scots pine in Scotland, at 6.09 metres. Look at the photos they took and you'll see that the landscape is similar to how Watson had found it 18 years earlier. All low-clipped heather and blaeberry, and no young trees. Change happens very slowly and very quickly in woodlands. The tree is a fair yomp from the path, through thickets of birch and pine and waist-high heather. I startle pearl-bordered fritillaries into flight, but it's still cold and they're not quite ready to go yet. The tree has grown in girth no more than 5 centimetres further since 2011. Two enormous limbs have been lost, each the size of a tree itself. But now the pine is surrounded by new growth. Young birches, rowans, willows, and pines crowd for attention, from knee height to twice my height. The tree is a monster. It's not as old as people think, more than 2 centuries old, but not much more than that. Its remarkable size is actually a product of human history. For the last 200 years, high numbers of red deer managed for sport have browsed away other trees that might have grown up to compete with it. Its size will ultimately prove to be its undoing, as it has made it unstable in the regular high winds that blow up along Deeside from Athol. Sitting on a broken limb worn smooth by previous sitters, I look around at the explosion of life. Spring comes late to the Cairngorms, and the birches are not quite in full leaf yet. But one day soon they will be, all of them, all of a sudden, just like that. Under a bough I see a rib from a red deer calf, and the find is just a tad on the nose for my taste. I could write that what has emerged at Mar Lodge is a demonstration project of what can be achieved when groups with different interests and different ideas about our landscapes work together, somewhat harmoniously for the common good. But, as we shall see, it is fairer to say that the truth of the matter is much more complicated than that. It's still cold, and I have many miles to walk, so I move on, deeper through the Mar Forest. The woodland opens up a couple of kilometres away at Black Bridge, which is actually a red bridge. Glenlewy, whose flanks were cleared of Caledonian pinewood in the 18th century, is the gateway to the southern Cairngorms. It now appears as a wilderness. But like all the Cairngorms glens, its human history is as old as the pinewoods themselves. The fertile floor, now a lush green wildflower meadow, was under the crofter's plough for centuries. The footprints of their sheilings and black houses litter the glen. The crofters were first cleared in 1726 to facilitate forestry operations, and again in 1840 to make way for deer to hunt. Humans and pine woods have both flourished and suffered in equal measure in this glen. Carnamaheim and Derry Cairngorm, gatekeepers themselves to Ben MacDhui Hov into view. There are snow patches on their eastern flanks, and I look forward to stomping through them in several hours' time. One time here I saw a juvenile golden eagle flying down the glen, attacked simultaneously by 2 buzzards, a kestrel, and 2 hen harriers. But today I make do with just a buzzard. These largish raptors, with their beautiful mewing call, were rare enough creatures themselves just a couple of decades ago. If they weren't competing with eagles for our cultural affections, we would think of them, perhaps, with the respect they deserve. As it is, I have started calling them just a buzzard. So regularly do I see them and think that they might be something rarer. Just a buzzards are a conservation success story. When we think of once-rare creatures as blithely as I think of just a buzzards, that is a sure sign of success. I share the glen with two walkers, weighed down with large rucksacks, looking to spend a couple of days up here in the heart of things. They don't see the Juster Buzzard, or maybe they have, and, like me, have dismissed it out of hand for its newfound ubiquity. There are tree plantations in the glen from in the 1970s. The Trust is working to make them less like plantations and more like native woodlands, removing non-native tree species, thinning clearings, and increasing the amount of deadwood in them. It's a slow process, and for now they remain slightly incongruous square blocks of trees. Willows and birches are growing, sometimes densely, sometimes sparsely, along the length of the open glen, for the first time in perhaps two centuries. Above all else, though, my eyes are drawn to the young pines. They pack themselves densely along the open sandy soils of the burnsides. They cluster around the older trees and woodland edges. They grow strongly in some patches, weaker in wetter areas, between knee-height and well over head-height. They send scouts across the landscape, their silhouettes breaking the skyline. One way or another, they are everywhere in this glen. I head past Derry Lodge, the Grand Hunting Lodge, and into Glen Derry, which is as remarkable a glen as any in Scotland. Caledonian pinewood drapes the lower reaches of the glen for a couple of miles, obscuring the hills. A merry band of Scottish crossbills calls from the tops of the trees. At Derry Dam, the pines begin to thin out, a relic of the forestry operations of the 18th century. Here the glen is laid bare, a vast U-shaped valley, hewn out by a monstrous glacier over 10,000 years ago, bounded by four Munros. Four great corries sprawl along its western flank, while scree slopes slouch the length of the eastern wall, a giant, dry-stained dike. To the north sit the tors of Benveyen, the middle hill, and further still the great forest of Abernethy. The scree slopes are the reason I'm here. I climb up to an outlying cluster of pines, isolated from the edge of the wood. It's tough going in the rough scree, but I notice small, wind-stunted pine seedlings popping through the rocks at my feet. These are the latest trees in a very special lineage. These are the descendants of Mar Lodge's oldest known tree. There it is, a lone pine, gnarled and twisted, with a sparse canopy, set back even from the other members of this isolated group. Were it not for the magnificent location, you'd be inclined to find this tree something of an anticlimax. But then, that is somewhat the point. Its location, cold and exposed, and lacking in nutrients and firm anchorage, has stunted its growth, and in so doing allowed it to last to an older age than is usual for Scots pine. It is dated to at least 1477, but it probably started growing sometime in the 1450s, making it one of the two oldest known Scots pines in Scotland. When Queen Victoria wrote about the fine firs of Glen Derry in her diaries, it was already an exceptionally old tree. It was old even when Glen Lewy was cleared of people to make way for deer to hunt. It was getting on for three centuries old when the last wolves of Scotland were killed, and when tens of thousands of trees were lost from the glen in the forestry operations of the 18th century. It was two centuries old and more when Bobbing John Erskine, 23rd Earl of Mar, raised the banner for the 15 Rebellion, only to forfeit the estate and flee to France. It was a century old when Mary, Queen of Scots, hunted in Mar and Atoll for deer and wolves. Sitting under its ancient boughs, I expect to think lofty Ozymandian thoughts about the transience of human life and the enduring reality of nature. Facing such exceptional age, with a tree which had seen so much of the comings and goings of humans for half a millennium and more, I expect to feel some communion with nature. As it is, I mostly feel cold and uncomfortable. I slide about on the screen, struggling to find a snug spot, and eventually make do with an awkward seat, one leg keeping me balanced, the other flopping around uselessly. So much for lofty thoughts. In Scotland, the largest parcels of land are sporting estates. In a British context, they are enormous. They are the principal reason that in 2012, 50% of Scotland's land had just 432 owners. A single owner has a huge amount of influence, for better or worse, over how that land is managed. My large estate is just such an estate, and a big one at that. It is an ancient royal forest, its land set aside for the joy of the hunt for a privileged elite. It was a place foris, subject to its own laws. As we shall see, this had an enormous bearing on its history and how we understand the land to this day. For 1,000 years and more, the estate has had a single owner at a time. This owner has changed with the political whims and caprices of the age, with the competence of the owners, and with their ability to produce heirs. But it has always had pedigree. The original Earls of Mar are among the oldest lineage of nobility in the world. The fortunes of the people of the estate were largely dependent on whoever happened to own the land at the time. The highest number of people living and working on Mar Lodge came at some point in the early 18th century. They were foresters and crofters. They would use the woods for fuel and construction. Their cattle would roam through the pine woods and summer high in the hills. Following the Jacobite Rebellion of 1715, the Earl of Mar forfeited his land, and the estate eventually made its way into the hands of William Duff, later to become the Earl of Fife. The crofters were cleared, first to make way for forestry operations, then to make way for deer to hunt. By the 1850s, the land was a playground for the aristocracy. Foresters and crofters were replaced with gamekeepers, paid to produce high numbers of game by whatever means necessary. Every year, Queen Victoria would arrive at nearby Balmoral for the season. She would ride out and enjoy the Mar Woods, already by this point depleted by centuries of felling for timber, and lament the loss of the pines of Craigbad and Eas, felled earlier that century and not regrown. Prince Albert would hunt stags on the Mar Lodge ground. In the late 19th century, following the marriage of the Earl of Fife to Princess Louise, first daughter of King Edward VII, it became a royal hunting lodge. In 1959, following the death of Princess Alexandra, the estate passed to a nephew, Captain Ramsay. In 1962, the majority of the estate was bought by the Panshow brothers, Swiss hoteliers who thought Mar Lodge could be turned into a ski resort. It could not, they eventually realized, but not before they had bulldozed vehicle tracks into the heart of the mountains in preparation for ptarmigan shooters and downhill skiers who would never come. In the 1980s, the land made its way into the hands of John Klug, an American oil tycoon. By 1995, the land had been managed first and foremost as a highland sporting estate for almost 2 centuries, while field sports had been undertaken on the land for getting on for a millennium. In that time, the culture of highland sport and gamekeeping had emerged across the highlands, and people had become used to the ways of life of a highland sporting estate. Whoever the owner and whatever their outlook and management of the land, gradually, over the centuries, the great pine woods of the Keogh, the Derry, Louis Beg, and Glendee were reduced to remnants. The woods and scrub of the mountains and burns were lost. The bogs became eroded and scarred. So too went the people, who had eked fields out of the unforgiving soils, leaving behind them the ruins of townships and shealings, and no less than 7 illicit whiskey stills. So too went the big mammals, the lynx, the boar, the beaver, the wolf, lost either through the destruction of their habitat or at the hands of hunters. Myriad other species, too small to notice or record for posterity, were lost and will never know for sure.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?